Sangye cho tang so ki cho nam la Chang chu bar du dag ni kyab su chi Dag yi jin so ki pi so nam ki Rula bin chu sangye du par shu I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assemblies. The virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. And the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all beings have happiness in the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering in the causes of suffering. May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless. And may all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and clinging. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water. In the middle is Mount Meru, surrounded by the four continents and ornamented by the sun and the moon. By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha realm, may all sentient beings partake Buddha's pure lands. Om Guru Buddha Bodhisattva Sapariva Ratnamanda Buddha Mega Samudra Saparana Samai. Okay, welcome. So, I put up another chart tonight just to give us an idea of where we've come from and where we're going. This is different than last week's. So we covered the impure vision, and we're now in the vision of experience. And we learned the three-step analytical meditation of loving-kindness, compassion, and enlightenment thought. And now we're going through the enlightenment thought, which is divided into two parts, relative and ultimate. The relative has wishing bodhicitta, or enlightenment thought. What does wishing enlightenment thought refer to?
It covers this.
Yeah, aspiration, strong aspiration, like I want to do this. Because we've gone through renunciation and the hell realms and faith and refuge and all that, and now we really want to do something. We want to attain enlightenment for the sake of all beings. And then the other part of it is entering. Yeah. So what is entering refer to?
Practice.
Yeah, the practice, and you actually do it. I'm going to get in the car and drive now. Okay. Entering. Okay, so we have the steps, the meditational steps of equality of self and others, and then exchanging self and others, these are the steps, and then the actual conduct, how do you do it? You know, the six perfections and so on, and the four means of gathering, and you all know all of those, so I won't ask you, no quiz tonight. So that's relative enlightenment thought, and tonight we're going to start looking at ultimate enlightenment thought, which is a big topic. So we need to be clear when we talk about these various topics, are we referring to relative or ultimate? Because our point of view and our language will change a little bit. So to avoid misunderstandings, it's good to say, well, I'm talking about relative or I'm talking about ultimate. Tonight we're going to talk about ultimate. Okay? So that's where we've come to at this point. Any questions or comment about any of this before we go on? Okay. So I think we left off on page 156, Ultimate Enlightenment Thought, and the combination of calm abiding and insight wisdom. Now, we've talked a little bit about calm abiding, but we're going to talk some more about it, and also insight wisdom, and also the combination of those. So the text starts out saying, though in most texts
There are differences in the manner of meditating upon the ultimate enlightenment thought. There are none with regard to the subject matter. So there's all kinds of different meditations that can be done around this topic, but there's no question about the subject matter itself. As it was stated in some of the old texts, I think that the meaning of then the ultimate enlightenment thought is selflessness, which is free from all substantiality, free from subject and object. Okay, there's a lot in that sentence there. It's my opinion that this is the pinnacle of the Buddha's teachings, what he brought, that I haven't seen anywhere else, this idea of emptiness and interdependence. And so this selflessness that's referred to here is not just the selflessness of myself, it's also what's called the selflessness of objects or others. So the emptiness of myself, my ego is an illusion, but also all the material things in our world, it's all illusory too. So we're going to go into that, and this attainment is only attainable through meditation. It's not enough to listen and contemplate. If you just stop there, you will not have the attainment. So there's going to be quite a bit of discussion later on how do you actually meditate on this topic. So we're going to get to that, but I just want to preview that point. So in order to meditate upon the meaning of this, there are, one, the explanation of the nature of the ultimate enlightenment thought, two, the teaching of the actual methods for producing it upon the mind, and three, the showing of the manner in which to practice the methods. So number one, the nature of the ultimate enlightenment thought. Beliefs that are held to be the truth, such as the self or soul, ascribed by the Hindus, the aggregates and sense spheres ascribed by the two schools of the Shravakas of the Hinayana tradition, the self-knowing mind ascribed by the Chittamatra of the Mahayana tradition, and the like, are mere imputations of the name ultimate enlightenment thought. So it's kind of a funny way of saying it, but basically what he's saying is all these other people got it wrong. They didn't get the full depth of it. We talked last week about the different divisions, the Shravakas and the Pratyeka Buddhas and so on. Those are the foundation school Buddhists. So there's a difference in how the Mahayana views this topic and the foundation folks view it. And then the Chittamatra, that's commonly called the mind-only school in English. And that is a Mahayana philosophy. The Sakyas consider it slightly imperfect, though. They don't consider it the ultimate meaning of ultimate enlightenment thought. And there's lots of debates. And in the philosophical schools, the monastics, they study these topics in great depth, and they debate them in great depth in order to understand all this. But what he's saying here is that all of these folks, these descriptions of self and soul and mind only and all that, are mere imputations. They're like labels that are tacked on, that are slapped on, but they're not really the true meaning of ultimate enlightenment thought. So he starts out by saying what it's not. It's not these philosophical schools and so on. And it's a conceptual extreme. So in this discussion, there's a lot of talk about extremes. So on the one hand, you have the extreme of nihilism, which is, well, nothing exists. That's one extreme. And that's just obviously not true. I mean, there are things, you know, there's a table here. So, but the other extreme is, Stephen, help me out. What is that term that you use for that? I'm kind of spacing out the name of that term.
The other eternalism.
Thank you, sir. Stephen knows a lot about this. So that is where most of us lean, which is, oh, this really exists. This table, me, all of this stuff really exists. It's truly existent. Right. And that is not the way it is according to Sakya and other folks. So you may have heard the term middle path or middle way. We're going to head towards the middle here. So we want to stay away from the two of extremes that nothing exists or everything is just solidly, independently, inherently existing. Neither one of those are really the true situation. And because we misinterpret all this, we think that our ego is real, and then we get into all kinds of non-virtuous activities to protect this ego, which doesn't exist anyway. You know, we get jealous and angry and lazy and do all these non-virtuous things. And that's really the source of our problem, which is self-cherishing. If you want to boil it down to why you suffer, it's self-cherishing. So that's kind of what he's aiming at here. So he says they are not the ultimate enlightenment thought. Instead, the root of all phenomena of both samsara, that is worldly existence, and nirvana, that is personal liberation, is the nature of the primordial mind, which from the very beginning has always remained free from all conceptual extremes. This is the ultimate enlightenment thought. And you might be asking, well, what does that mean? We're going to go into this in the next pages. We're going to explore this topic about what it is and how to meditate on it and how to experience it, how to attain it. Okay. And Master Nagarjuna said, the enlightenment thought of the Buddhas, which is not obscured by conceptualizations of self, of aggregates, and of self-knowing consciousness, is explained to have the defining characteristic of emptiness always. It's not the conceptualization of self, the self that we think is real and protect all the time, which is an illusion. It's not that. It's not the aggregates. Remember we talked about the aggregates? Five aggregates. Form, feeling, perception, so on. It's not those. Nor is it the self-knowing consciousness. And that, I believe, refers to the mind-only school, which is in the previous paragraph. And according to the Sakya philosophers, mind-only school almost gets it right, but they think that the mind is real. Now, not everybody thinks that mind-only thinks that, but we're not here to do a philosophical debate tonight, and I'm not sure I'm qualified anyway. But I'm just saying what he's referring to here, because Nagarjuna is in this camp, obviously. Okay.
Madhyamika.
Yeah. So this is the root of happiness and suffering of worldly existence and personal liberation, because if one realizes its essence, i.e. its thatness, one will simultaneously realize the essence of all phenomena also. As it was said by Acharya Aryadeva, the essence of one entity is the essence of all entities. The essence of all entities is the essence of one entity. Whoever realizes the essence of one entity will realize the essence of all entities.
One taste.
Yeah, so that's rather abstract, but what it's saying in kind of simplistic terms is the Sakyas refer to it as the inseparability of samsara and nirvana, which is, there is no samsara out there and there is no nirvana out there apart from our mind. It's all mind created. It's just that our minds are obscured. We have Buddha nature, but it's covered over with negativity. And the realization of that, the actual realization of it through meditation, is how you get free from samsara and how you experience nirvana, because it's all in your mind anyway. This is all real abstract at this point for us, but the meditations that we're going to learn will lead us into this process of sorting through this and eventually attaining the realization.
So,
yes, sir.
Another point is that it's worth unpacking the term negativity as it comes. Well, I don't know that it's time to do that, but it's worth doing.
Okay.
In that the negativity that's being pointed at is that is more. It's not like the opposite of what's correct. It's not like incorrect. It's more like a photographic negative, in that it isn't the thing it represents. It's a reference to the thing it represents. Dalai Lama says, for instance, we think a bowl. Okay? So now this is a negative phenomenon. This is the negativity we're talking about.
A bowl?
A bowl. We think bowl.
Uh-huh.
But that bowl has no clay. It has no cracks. It has no glaze. It isn't a bowl. But it's a negative of the bowl. It's like the negative of a photograph.
Oh, okay.
It represents the bowl, but it isn't the bowl.
Okay.
So in that, in this context, in this lexicon, that's negativity. It isn't making a mistake. It's seeing things wrong.
Yeah.
Backwards.
Yeah. Okay.
It's really existing.
Okay. All right.
Oh, yeah, not seeing reality for what it
is. Yeah.
Okay. Also, obscurations of the mind that cloud up.
Yeah.
Cloud the mind up, right?
Yeah. Okay, so that introduction, that's the introduction to the nature of the ultimate enlightenment thought. It's kind of abstract, but it's we got to start somewhere, right?
Right.
So now, number two is the methods for producing the ultimate enlightenment thought upon the mind. And for this, there are two aspects, calm abiding and insight wisdom. Now, we've talked a little bit before about calm abiding. We're going to talk in a fair amount of detail here coming up. So that's one aspect of it. And then insight wisdom is the other aspect that we're going to talk about, and those are the methods for producing the ultimate enlightenment thought upon the mind. Calm abiding is having relied upon the method which holds the mind, all discriminating thoughts are pacified, and the mind is placed upon and remains in its own radiance. Now, we talked before about the definition of meditation. It was in the book. Does anybody remember the definition of meditation?
Which kind of meditation?
That was in the book here.
Oh.
Just general.
It's becoming familiar with.
Yeah. There's two pieces to it. It's
oh, like seeing and
focusing. Focusing. One-pointed focusing.
Yeah.
Which is a very high attainment when you actually attain it. Upon what?
Analytical.
A virtuous object.
Oh,
right. Stanley Cup finals don't count.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we talked about calm abiding. So that's the method.
Unless you see the Stanley Cup finals as being empty.
They're empty, yeah. The cup is empty.
If you see the, it, then it becomes a virtuous object.
Yeah. I don't see it that way, though. I see it as a hockey prize. Okay. So the method which holds the mind, that's your focusing, yeah, this one-pointed focusing. All discriminating thoughts are pacified. So in certain kinds of meditation, the focusing itself allows the settling of the mind. Okay, so you're not forcing your thoughts to stop, but there's a kind of...
you don't engage with them.
The silt settles. Yeah. And the mind is placed upon and remains in its own radiance. So this refers to when you get to this state where you're focused and your thoughts settle and you have these gaps in between your thought, then the natural luminosity of the mind sort of appears or you experience it. So that's the radiance that they're referring to here, that he's referring to. So that's just kind of a quick summary of calm abiding. And then the second part, insight wisdom, having dispelled the obscuring veil of subject and object, one penetrates into the true nature of all phenomena individually without confusing them and sees the face of the primordial mind itself. So there's a two-step process here. We have to cultivate calm abiding and get a certain level of it. And then we have the ability to focus on the insight wisdom part of this process. So we start to remove this, he calls it an obscuring veil of subject and object, which is where we are kind of normally in samsara. Subject and object, I'm here and the table's over there. And we penetrate into the true nature of all phenomena without confusing them. And that's this experience of seeing the primordial mind. So again, this is something that's only attainable in the meditative process. It's not, you don't get it by reading this book.
After lots and lots and lots of practice.
Okay. So as it was said in the Precious Cloud Sutra, what is calm abiding? It is one-pointedness of mind. What is insight wisdom? It is the perfect realization of each and every phenomena. So that is a very pithy, succinct summary of what we're talking about here.
And so we're going to talk. Perfect realization is emptiness. Perfect realization is emptiness.
Yeah.
Of realization of what?
Emptiness of all phenomena. That's
perfect
realization.
Perfect realization
is the emptiness of all phenomena. That's what we're ultimately trying to attain, right?
Mm. Stephen's thinking about it.
That's
fine.
Huh? Half of it.
Yeah.
What's the other half?
The integration of emptiness with form.
Yeah.
The form is emptiness, and emptiness is form.
That's the integration.
Yeah. But you
We're going to do some merging things here. In a minute.
Yeah.
Or maybe
you
in
said
a while.
The same thing.
No. Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Yeah. Essentially, that's what I'm saying. Well, form is emptiness. Emptiness is form.
Right. And that's an integration.
Which is the emptiness of all phenomena.
It's the integration of form and emptiness.
Right. Which is empty. Emptiness.
It's form and emptiness. It's an integration of form and emptiness.
And when you integrate them, it's emptiness, right? How can you have form and emptiness at the same time?
That's why we're not Buddhists, because we can't grasp
that. Well, we are Buddhists. That's the learning part of it. But that's a high kind
that's
of thing.
That's what you want to know.
Well, that's right. Okay. So we're saying the same thing.
You want to know what the integration is.
Yeah, okay. I got it. I just don't express it the same way you do.
Okay.
But I understand it.
Good.
Okay, good.
And we're Buddhists, because that's what we're learning. That's what being Buddhist is, learning this stuff.
Fair enough. I guess it depends what you consider. I don't consider myself a Buddha, but it's
important. Oh, we're not a Buddha. Well, right. The Buddha nature's there. We're just developing it.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Even non-Buddhists have Buddha nature.
Yeah, that's right.
your pet dog has Buddha nature. Okay, so, and then there's another quote from the Sutra Lankara, having settled the mind in the right way, to rest the mind upon the mind and to thoroughly penetrate all phenomena is called calm abiding and insight wisdom. So typically when people learn to meditate, they have an object. So it might be a picture of the Buddha, or it might be a stone, or it might be a flower, or it might even be a thought like compassion, or, you know, any of these topics. But we have an object that we meditate on, that we focus on. That's the focusing, that's the thing we focus on. And that's how we learn to meditate. But there is another kind of meditation which they're talking about here, which where the mind itself becomes the object. So in order to do that, you have to calm down all discursive monkey mind chatter that is going on, and that has to be settled. Otherwise, you can't focus on the mind because you're chattering and chattering and chattering away and being distracted. And we're going to talk about that too some more. So that's what they're referring to here when you say to rest the mind upon the mind. So we know we have a mind, but mostly we don't really think about it much.
You can't think about
And there's a little experiment I'd like to, or a little exercise I'd like to do with you, if you're willing. So just close your eyes and point to the part of your body where your mind is.
That's hard.
Okay, just try.
Like, what type of mind? Don't we have different types of minds?
Just try it. Okay. Okay, so we got a smart class here. They're questioning the premise of the exercise. So most people, I've done this exercise lots of times with lots of different people, and most people, at least most Westerners anyway, will point to their head.
Yeah, the brain.
And if you hear people talk, very often they equate the brain and the mind in their language.
Western science thinks it's...
If you ask this question to an Easterner that hasn't been Westernized too much, they will point to their heart. But still, most people point somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Unless they're a Buddhist and they know the exercise.
Yeah.
Or, I don't know where my mind is. So here's part two of the exercise. Close your eyes and pinch your arm to the point where it hurts a little bit. Now where is your mind?
There.
Well, it's focused on the pinch.
Yeah. So the point being what? That the mind doesn't have a physical location. And if you want to pursue this further, it doesn't even have to be inside your body, although we tend to think that it is. Mm-hmm. So these are just little examples to get us kind of out of our box of either, one, not thinking about our mind, or two, thinking it's our brain, or whatever we think. And we really don't know what the nature of it is, because we'd never meditated on it. So that's what this meditation refers to, is this meditation of taking the mind itself as your object and then going in deep, and we'll find out what happens later as we go through the text here. But that's what he's referring to here. So that concludes the method for producing the enlightenment thought upon the mind. And number three is the manner in which to practice whichever method has been taught. Obviously, there's lots and lots of methods here. We're just going through one of them here. So the manner in which to practice whichever method has been taught is A, to meditate on calm abiding, B, to meditate on insight wisdom, and C, to meditate on the merging of these two. Now, you might say, well, what is the merging of these two? So, later on in the text, and I'm just going to go to it right now, on page 195, there is a definition of the merging of calm abiding and insight wisdom. You see that where it says see? Mm-hmm. Mixing together the stilling of all thoughts, in which there is no mental activity whatsoever at the time of calm abiding, and the destruction of all imputations by perfect wisdom, in which no objects of mental activity whatsoever are found at the time of insight wisdom, into the one taste of the practice of meditating nothing whatsoever is the practice of the merging of calm abiding and insight wisdom. Okie dokie. So now we're going to go into all this in more detail, starting with calm abiding. Would somebody like to take over reading?
I can read.
Mm-hmm.
As it was said in the Bodhicaryavatara, having known that the afflictions are thoroughly destroyed by insight wisdom, which is thoroughly endowed with calm abiding, one should first of all strive for calm abiding. That too is achieved by being without attachment to worldly pleasures.
Okay, so we have the relative bodhicitta, which calms down our afflictions. It kind of gets them under control, so to speak, but it doesn't destroy them. It's the ultimate enlightenment thought that actually destroys the afflictions. And so we need both of these.
Hmm? Have we talked about the afflictions?
Yeah, like jealousy, anger, yeah. Ignorance,
desire,
the three poisons, yeah. And all the derivatives of the three poisons. Miser, those are the afflictions, yeah. So we need to understand it's a two-step process. And that's why the afflictions are thoroughly destroyed by insight wisdom, endowed with calm abiding. And to do that, you need to be without attachment to worldly pleasures. So that's renunciation that we've talked about too. In other words, if you don't have renunciation, you're not going to do the work. You're going to be living your life like you've always lived for countless eons, circling in samsara. Okay.
Therefore, insight wisdom is necessary to extract the affliction of self-grasping from its root, and calm abiding is necessary to produce that insight wisdom. Since calm abiding depends upon isolation of the body and mind to arise, one should first abandon all worldly activities like farming and trading, and all mental relations to outer inner sense desire objects like attachment to other living beings. If one does not abandon these, one will not be able to produce the real meditative state of one-pointedness of mind. Furthermore, there will be the fault of attachment to worldly activities.
Okay, so what do we need? We need the wisdom, the ultimate, to destroy our afflictions. And to have that, we need calm abiding. And to have that, we need to have renunciation. So they're not caught up in worldly activities 24/7. And we need to actually sit down and do the work of the meditation that gets us this result. There is no other way. There's no shortcuts. Okay. And not only that, but if you don't do that, you're going to be attached to worldly activities, you know. And we've already talked in the past about how that can lead us into all kinds of problems and troubles. And there's a famous Sakya teaching, the parting from the four attachments. And the first attachment is that attachment, the attachment of worldly existence or worldly activities and all the stuff we're caught up in. And that's the first of these four attachments that keep us bound into the cycle of suffering. I mean, we suffer because of that. So there's a kind of, you know, there's a kind of a list of things that we have to go through in order to get to this very high level. We're talking about a very high attainment here. We're talking about Buddhahood, really. So we need to know the steps, and then we need to do the steps.
As it was said in the
sutra.
A sutra. If advised by the teacher, one's mind isn't pleased by the order, and if instructed to follow, one doesn't follow it accordingly. The moral conduct of such a person quickly spoiled. These faults are caused by fondness of worldly activities. If one is a layman, since one's mind is always attached to the activities of one's residence, that person will always suffer, will not meditate, and will not practice abandonment of faults and the like. These faults are caused by fondness of worldly activities. Concerning the fault of attachment to sense desire objects, it was said in the Bodhicaryavatara, desires produce harmful results in this world and in the next. Here, one is killed, bound, and cut, and in the next will obtain the suffering of the hells and the like. And also, one should recollect the verse from the
Bodhicaryavatara.
Okay, thank you. Because of the torments of accumulating, guarding, and losing it, wealth should be known as boundless misery. There is no opportunity for liberation from the world's suffering for those who are distracted by the attachment to wealth. Concerning the fault of attachment to sentient beings, it was stated in the Bodhicaryavatara. Santideva, thank you. If one has attachment to sentient beings, the view of reality becomes completely obscured. Even the mind of sadness is destroyed, and finally one becomes afflicted by grief.
So, excuse me for stopping you there. What do you think that means, even the mind of sadness is destroyed?
What is the mind of sadness then? The mind of loss.
Don't we want sadness to be destroyed? You want to be sad?
No, I think you do, because you want to cause... Isn't that part of renunciation?
Exactly. Exactly. Sadness is an important part of renunciation. The lamas say it's really important to get in touch with your sadness and just say, you know what, this samsara thing really, it's a drag. I don't want any more of it. Good.
Through thinking only of them, this life uselessly passes away.
Even the perfect Dharma will be destroyed by these impermanent friends and relatives. If one equally participates in the behavior of childless people, one will definitely go to the lower realms. If it leads to unfortunate conditions, what is the use of associating with the childish? In one moment they become friends, and then instantly they turn into enemies. Since they are angered in joyful situations, worldly people are hard to please. Though one speaks beneficially, they are angered and also turn one away from benefit. If one does not heed their counsel, then due to their anger, they go to the lower realms. They are jealous towards superiors, competitive towards equals, condescending towards inferiors, conceited when praised, and become angry when spoken to unpleasantly. When is benefit ever derived from the childish? If one associates with the childish, there will definitely arise non-virtue, such as praising oneself, belittling others, discussions of the delight of worldly existence, and so on. Also, it was said by Jetsun Rinpoche Dapa, having resided in an isolated place, there one should meditate upon concentration, since if one associates with the childish, one will not obtain isolation. Therefore, one should meditate renunciation from living beings. Through this, one will obtain isolation and will abandon wrong livelihood. Likewise, one should also abandon a hateful mind towards enemies. As Shantideva said, if the pain of hatred is held in the heart, the mind does not experience peace. Not obtaining joy and happiness, sleep will not come, and one will become undependable. Though they depend upon him through whose kindness they receive wealth and respect, still servants wish to kill the master who possesses hatred. By anger, one's friends and relatives become revulsed. Though gathered by one's generosity, they do not support one. In brief, there is no one who can dwell happily with anger. Besides these verses, one should also recollect other excerpts stated on the occasion of the discussion of cause and effect in the same text. In this way, one should abandon all attachments toward the objects of hatred and desire, and taking up residence alone in such places as in a hermitage, in the mountains, on the edge of a forest, and the like. One should meditate on transic absorption.
Transic absorption is calm abiding.
As it was said by Shantideva, therefore, I myself should dwell alone in very pleasant and beautiful forests, while remaining happy, blissful, with little difficulties, and pacifying all distractions. Also in the same text it was said, having contemplated the virtues of solitude in these and other ways, one should completely still conceptualizing thoughts and then meditate on the enlightening thought.
Okay, so this is a long discussion about renunciation and the problems with attachment, and just trying to encourage you to shift your emphasis towards this goal of first calm abiding and then ultimate enlightenment thought. We are going to find out now the nuts and bolts of how do you actually do this.
One, the five faults and the eight antidotes or corrective measures. Having resided in a solitary place, one should meditate on calm abiding through first recognizing the five faults to be rejected, then relying upon the eight corrective measures of those faults. Finally, one should seek calm abiding through the 9 methods of placing the mind. The 5 faults are, 1, laziness, which does not apply the mind to virtuous action. 2, even though applied to virtue, one forgets the instructions for meditating upon transic absorptions. 3, even though not forgotten, the mind is clouded and unclear, or due to sluggishness and unruliness, one's thoughts do not settle. 4, even though one knows that one's mind has fallen into a sluggish or unruly state, one is inactive and does not look for its antidotes. And 5, due to overapplication of the antidotes, one's mind becomes overactive and cannot remain settled.
These are teachings from Maitreya, our friend Maitreya here. Anybody remember who Maitreya is?
The Buddha of Compassion.
No, that's Chenrezig.
Oh, that's Chenrezig.
That one? Is that your title?
This is a picture of Maitreya, a Tanka. How many Buddhas are there going to be in this era?
He's
the next one. There's going to be 1,000. And he's next in line. He was actually a disciple of Shakyamuni Buddha. But we have access to some of his teachings through Asanga, who was a great practitioner and philosopher, who actually did a 12-year retreat to meet him, and actually at the end did meet Maitreya. Maitreya took him to his Buddha realm and gave him teachings. So we have 5 texts from Maitreya, even though he hasn't appeared yet as the Buddha. So we've got sort of a preview. And this teaching that right here is from Maitreya. And it's fairly famous, the 5 faults and the 8 antidotes. Now, the first one is laziness, and we've talked already extensively here about laziness and the different kinds of laziness and so on. So that's the first one. And then the second one, even though applied to virtue, one forgets the instructions upon meditating. So we were taught how to meditate, but we forgot. So that's a fault, obviously. That's, remember the 3 different cups? Which cup is that one?
Cracked?
Hmm?
Is that the cracked?
Yeah, the cracked cup. It's leaked out the context, so we forgot the instructions. That's the second fault. And then the third fault, even though the instructions were not forgotten, the mind is clouded and unclear, or due to sluggishness and unruliness, one's thoughts do not settle. So sluggishness and unruliness are very commonly translated as sinking and scattering. And there's other words you can use too. But basically, sinking is when you get really sleepy and drowsy and heavy and not alert and awake. And there's different levels of sinking. There's gross and subtle and so on. But basically, your mind is going down. It's sinking. Scattering, on the other hand, is the opposite. That's the monkey mind that chatters away and is discursive thinking that just doesn't stop and on and on. And that's scattering. Or here they call it unruliness. So those are 2 extremes, right? You're either way, way down or way, way up. And there's various antidotes for all of these, which we'll find out shortly. And then the fourth one is, even though you know that your mind has fallen into sinking or scattering, you're inactive and you don't look for the antidotes. So you don't apply the antidotes that we're going to learn soon. So that's a fault. Oh yeah, my mind is scattering, but I kind of like it. I'm just going to keep going and thinking about it. You don't apply the antidote to that. That's a fault. Or the same way with thinking. I'm really sleepy. Oh well, I'll just have a nap. So you do not apply the antidotes when you recognize the problem is a fault in itself. And then the next one is to over-apply the antidotes. If you take too much of the medicine and you make yourself sick. So if you do too much reining in of the monkey mind, then you get really tight. Your mind gets really tight, and we don't want to meditate with a tight mind. You want to be relaxed. You know, you want to be alert and awake, but not tense. you actually make the scattering worse when you do that. If you squeeze it too tight, it gets worse.
You mean it becomes more scattered?
Yeah.
So you just want to try and stay alert.
Yeah.
To what's going on.
So those are the five faults. It's good to memorize those, I think. And Maitreya's text is called The Clear Distinction Between Middle Way and Extremes, and he says, laziness, forgetting the instructions, sluggish and unruly mind, inactivity and overactivation, these are believed to be the five faults. So it's good to know what they are and have them clear in your mind when you have a meditation session. Now we're going to find out the antidotes.
From among the eight corrective measures that relinquish the faults, four are the antidotes for laziness. The first fault to be abandoned. These are earnestness, diligence, faith, and purity. Earnestness is the abode of the states of transient absorption. Diligence is to remain in that abode. Faith is the cause of earnestness. Purity is the result of diligence.
So it's interesting that of the faults, laziness has four antidotes. So laziness is a big problem. Actually, just getting started, getting going, sitting down on the cushion and doing it. That's the fault that I think most of us have, at least in the beginning anyway. Most people don't meditate and most people put it off. I'm too tired, I'm too busy, I can't do it. All these excuses that we make that are just forms of laziness. And so we really need to get a handle on laziness right off the bat. Otherwise, this other stuff doesn't even happen. If we're not sitting on the cushion meditating, we're not going to have sinking and scattering, are we?
Among these four, diligence is the principal one, since effort is the meaning of diligence. It is very important to abandon laziness and to arouse effort. As it was said by Shantideva, through being patient in this way, one should arouse effort. For enlightenment exists only for those who have effort. Just as there is no motion without air, so merit does not arise without effort. What is effort? It is fondness for virtue.
Okay, so do you remember when we were talking about the six perfections? There was a perfection called effort or diligence. You remember that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you remember I said I didn't like that translation. I got a better, a more favorable way that I prefer.
Joyful enthusiasm. Joyful
enthusiasm. And what do they say there? Fondness for virtue. Fondness. There's joy. We want to have... If you're doing this out of, oh, I got to go meditate, you're not going to do it. You're not. You need to have something joyful. You know, you want to be motivated by positivity. I want to do this. And once you get into it and you learn how to do it, then it's just natural because you know the benefits of it. It's like, well, I don't want to go to the gym, but I feel better afterwards, so I'll go to the gym anyway.
It's like looking at the bigger picture.
Yeah, and knowing the result, like what you're going to get out of it, okay? I mean, I don't always feel like meditating every day, but I do it because I know the result. But you got to get over that laziness hump. And joy, in my opinion, is the key, wanting it and getting something out of it that's positive. So, and that's what I think they're saying here, fondness for virtue.
What is virtue?
It's the opposite of non-virtue.
No.
That's what Geshe-la said when I asked him. Do you know what non-virtue is? The 10 non-virtuous acts and then the opposites.
Mm-hmm. He said power.
Power?
It was synonymous with the word term power.
To
benefit oneself and others.
Yeah, I believe that. He also said Dharma knowledge is power.
That would be a benefit to your
Yeah.
But when you break power down, it's compassion and kindness and generosity and all that stuff.
Yeah. Benefit from others. And
break it down to the virtue.
Okay.
The opposing forces of effort are described in the same text. Its opposing forces are explained to be laziness, attachment to vices, tardiness, and self-despising. Through experiencing the pleasures of idleness and craving for sleep, one will not feel sadness for the sufferings of worldly existence, and laziness will be strongly produced. Therefore, one should discard all these causes of laziness and should diligently meditate upon the transient absorptions by recollecting the faults of worldly existence, the difficulty of obtaining the prerequisites, and the impermanence of life.
We've talked about those before. the faults of worldly existence we've talked about. Okay, so you have renunciation. The difficulty of obtaining prerequisites, what's that?
Being born as human.
What do we call that?
Precious
human rebirth. We talked about that quite a bit. And then impermanence of life. Impermanence we've also talked about. So you need to recollect those. That's why we did the first part of this text first. Because without doing that, none of this would make any sense. So we have a foundation now. And we need to recall those, okay?
The antidotes for forgetting the instructions are mindfulness and alertness. Whatever subjects of instructions for meditating upon the transic absorptions are given, they should be brought to mind through mindfulness and should be held there without forgetting through alertness.
Okay, excuse me. Now we get into some semantics here, and I think we need to clarify this a little bit, what the words are, because this word mindfulness has been kind of popularized in recent times. And the meaning that's been popularized is a little bit different in this mindfulness context that he's talking about here. So I personally was taught the word memory rather than mindfulness, and to not confuse with the mindfulness that's going around everywhere, it seems like, these days, I always substitute memory in this kind of context, because what they're really saying is remembering the instructions that you were taught how to meditate. That's what it means. It's not mindfulness like I'm going to go for a walk and go really slow or I'm going to eat really slowly. It's not that kind of mindfulness in this case. It's memory. It's remembering. Alertness here is also translated as awareness, which is another one of these words that has a lot of different meanings. But basically what it boils down to is I'm going to remember the instructions on how to meditate, and I'm going to watch to see if I'm doing it. I'm going to watch and see if I've got sinking or scattering. I'm going to watch if I'm being lazy. I'm going to watch if I'm under-applying the antidotes. I'm going to watch if I'm over-applying the antidotes. So watchfulness, on the relative level, you have a kind of another part of your mind that's watching the process of meditation. On the ultimate level, there's not parts to your mind, but we're talking relative here. So I'm remembering the instructions of meditating, and I'm watching to make sure that I'm sticking to the rules, so to speak, parentheses, of course, the technique. And when I'm not doing it, what am I going to do? I'm going to apply the antidote that's appropriate to the amount that's appropriate. So that's what the terminology that they're referring to, mindfulness and alertness. And as I said, transic absorption refers to calm abiding. And they should be brought to mind through mindfulness and should be held there without forgetting through alertness. So just be careful when you hear these words. Be careful of the context that they're being used in, because the meaning can shift, as all words shift according to context. But particularly this word mindfulness these days, it's everywhere. I saw online there's a course for mindfulness for Wall Street brokers.
I know. It's big in business. Well, I heard the Dalai Lama describe mindfulness. He goes, it's not an end result, it's a tool.
Okay. And he should know, yeah.
Which is what alertness and mindfulness here are tools we use to train ourselves, right?
Okay. You want to keep going there?
As it was said by...
Mm-hmm.
No one a hearing, contemplating.
Mm-hmm.
Where? Oh, right, that's right, yeah. So it was said by Shantideva, the hearing, contemplation, and meditation of those possessing the fault of non-alertness will not be retained within their memory, like the water in a leaky vase. The antidote for failing to recognize the sluggish and unruly state is to see whether one has come under the influence of sluggishness or unruliness. Since sluggishness and unruliness are the principal opposing forces to the transic absorptions, if one fails to recognize them, one will not be able to rely upon the antidotes. Even though recognized, one does not necessarily activate the methods for dispelling sluggishness and unruliness, so the antidote itself is activation. The reason for this is that even though one recognizes what is to be abandoned, if the antidote is not relied upon, the qualities of meditation will not be produced upon one's mind. The antidote for the unsettled mind that has become very agitated through strong over-application is to rely upon the mental activity of equanimity. If the mind is maintained through balance, as gold is carefully weighed or a wise man is careful in his speech, then one will easily and happily gain the aims for which one wishes. Concerning these also, it was said in the Madhyanta Vibhanga, abode, abiding in it, cause, result, not forgetting the instruction of meditation, knowing the sluggish and unruly states, the mental activity to manifestly discard them, and to place the mind in meditation when it is calmed.
Okay, so that's quite a bit right there, going through the faults and the antidotes. I think I want to stop here because the next section is a whole other thing. So it's good to really, if you haven't already, to try to really integrate this, you know, in your practice. Learn what the faults and the antidotes are, and then practice applying them. You know, that's the memory part of this, learning it and doing it, you know. And as we said before, the attainment of the ultimate level requires meditation, so you're going to have to learn to do this anyway, if you haven't already. But it really is helpful to have an outline, to have instructions of, well, if this happens, do this, if that happens, do that, so that you begin to train your mind to avoid these extremes, and you stay somewhat in the middle anyway. And like anything, the more you do it, the easier it gets. And so you don't have to do this kind of constant antidote thing. You just do a little tweaking here and there, you know, to bring your mind back to where it should be. Eventually, you don't even have to do that. I mean, really, super advanced meditators don't even have to do that. But this is great instruction. This is really precious, precious stuff here to actually learn how to meditate. Everybody says, oh, yeah, I know how to meditate. And then you ask them what they're doing, they don't have a clue. Not everybody, but, you know. So this section, I think, is really important, and that's another reason I think we'll just stop here for now and integrate that this week. And hopefully for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. Any comments, questions, complaints? No?
So essentially, well, what I've been taught is that, so what I'm working on calm abiding right now, meditation, to be able to then get to the wisdom stuff. So that takes a long, long, long time. But that's how I think about it, is just, this is what I'm focusing on right now. And
yeah.
However long it takes, that's how long it takes.
And it can take a long time.
Oh, for
it
sure, I expect it will.
It can take a very short time. It depends entirely on the person.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah. It's going to take me a long time.
she's
convinced.
As far as
she had her watchfulness. She had her watchfulness activated.
No, but I just know. I mean, what's a long time? It's all relative, right? So...
Yeah.
I mean,
time is relative.
That's right.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get it in a week. I know that. Unless I go give up sex, rock, and roll and go to the mountains, then, you know. And it'll come a lot quicker, but that ain't going
to
happen.
There's
so.
People that go to the mountains and don't give up sex and rock and roll.
That's right. Going to the mountains is only part of it. Your mind has to go to the mountains.
Really going to the mountains, as we say.
People that stay in town and give that stuff up.
Yeah, well, it's all...
Well, I lived in the mountains. There's plenty of sex, drugs, and rock and roll in the mountains. Some mountains.
That's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Okay, any other comments? Shall we say the dedication prayers? So nam de tong cha zig pa nyi tong na ne ve da nam bom ji ji ke gana chi ma ung tu pe sit pe so le do wa du wa sh
Rinpoche, Sinjo Rinpoche, Ma Ke Panam Ke Gyurjin, Ke Manyam Parme Paryam, Gong Me Gong Tu Pel Parsho, Jampa Pa O Jitar Ken Padam, Kuntu Sang Bodhi Yung De Jinte, De Da Kungi Je Su Da Lo Chi, Ge Wa Di Ak Tam Che Rab Tu Nung, Tu Su She Pi Gya Wa Tam Che Ki, Nu Wa Gang Wa Chung Tu Nga Pa Gi, Dakshin ge pe tsa wa di kun kyang Sang po chu ji rab tu ngu ar gi Chak tsa wa dang cho ching sha pa dong Jesu yi rang go shing so wa gi Ge wa chung ze da gi ji sa
By this merit, may all attain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy of your own doing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious, may it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen. May it never decline where it has arisen. May it never grow and flourish. In whatever way Vananda, Jushri, and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues that I might train to be like them. Through this dedication, praise is supreme by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future. I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. May whatever little virtue I may have gained from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching, be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment.